The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
Going back to Kennedy, the first telegenic man running for president, and ever since, that's been an issue, you know, who looks good on stage, who photographs well, who doesn't sweat under the light of the camera. And in a way, I think this is another referendum on that, because do you go with the one who's, you know, Mr. Glitter and Gold and so shiny that you can't take your eyes off of him, but God knows what he says, or you go with her?
You know, it's quite interesting. I mean, John F. Kennedy perhaps was the start of that, where you're voting for the charismatic candidate. But then, if you move ahead a couple of decades, then you had Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was an actor, and he was able to take his aw shucks demeanor and just run his opposition into the ground. Jimmy Carter was probably eminently more qualified, but he was beaten by Ronald Reagan. And then you got to Barack Obama, who basically was able to use his charisma and his storyline to be successful and be two terms. And you had George W. Bush. He was able to beat Al Gore, who had had long experience. In each case, the personality seemed to, and dare I say the word, trump the qualifications. And now we get to the point of Donald Trump, who not only shoots from the hip, but he shoots people from the hip.
That Bob Franken. What a way with words. And what an understanding of our nation's politics. And why not? The Emmy Award-winning veteran correspondent has seen it all in his storied career. Today on the Helicaster Jane Show, Bob Franken joins me at my table when we take a frankincense look, the name of the syndicated column, at election 2016. We'll be back with Bob Franken in a minute, but first, welcome. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. Today, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by our new partner, our favorite store, the finest in offering gourmet foods, Dean and DeLuca. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, SoundCloud, the iHeartRadio Network, and at our newest home, on Google Play Music. Emmy Award-winning reporter Robert E. Bob Franken has seen it all. In a career spanning 30 years, he's been right there covering unfolding dramas, reporting on national political campaigns, international conflicts, and major natural disasters. He's covered combat in both Iraq wars, the White House during the President George W. Bush administration, the impeachment proceedings of President Bill Clinton, the Supreme Court, and Congress, and he forced world attention on the Guantanamo Bay prison camp with extensive on-location reporting. During a 20-plus year career at CNN, Franken served as the network's Capitol Hill correspondent and as a Supreme Court and White House reporter. He covered breaking news, including the 9/11 attacks and countless presidential and congressional campaigns. Franken's most memorable story? Well, we'll have to ask him about that and about that piquant wit of his that shows up in a syndicated column, Frankincense. What becomes a legendary newsman? Let's talk.
So, Mr. Bob,
you.
I know you don't like to talk about yourself, but we are going to start talking about you, okay?
Actually, I do love talking about myself.
I'm so glad. That's what you say on air. I know what you tell me off air, but listen to me. I really do want to talk to you because what a career you've had. I mean, it's just a storied career. Everybody should have what happened to you happen to them. But you know what? There's like a little bit of like misinformation out there on the web, but I want to find out some of it. Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Baltimore, but raised in Little Rock, Arkansas, and then left and didn't really go back until the Clintons got elected. And then, of course, I spent an awful lot of time back in Arkansas.
Arkansas? What were you doing in Arkansas? That is so funny.
Oh, it is such a long story. The short version is that my parents, who were immigrants, came here and came to Baltimore, and then it was a period of time when the South was looked at as an area of opportunity, so we moved down there. Of course, got there just in time for all the civil rights struggles and all that kind of thing, and so I left and really never went back.
Ha. Huh. You know, you news guys, you're a different breed of cat. You do know that, right?
Well, we, you know, first of all, we never grow up, and that's a good thing. And you know, you're sort of in the biz, and basically you're skeptical of everything. That's what we do.
That is absolutely it, and that's exactly where I was going with it, because I want to know how that was. That a gene you inherited? What was that? Did some kid on a school playground, you know, get you to let go? I'm not trusting. I'm scared. How did that happen?
Well, you know, again, I grew up in Arkansas, and there was an awful lot to be skeptical of down there when I was growing up. And I had intellectual parents proving that the acorn can call far from the tree.
Uh-huh.
They just, you know, I was sort of raised in this be skeptical of everything, sort of this the mantra that you've heard, I know, which is if your mother says she loves you, check it out.
So Arkansas is never going to ask you to come home to do PR for them, are they?
I don't think so. Although when I would go down there, and we were very pro civil rights,
right.
My family was, and so that meant that I probably fought my way through high school as much as anything else. And so I would go down there now to cover the Clintons, and you know, I'd have people come up and say, oh, Bob, we have such fond memories. And I'd say, fond memories? You threatened to burn a cross in my yard, you know.
You were raised Jewish, too, weren't you?
Well, no, in fairness, I mean, it's certainly the South has changed an awful lot.
Yeah, right. I understand that. But I started to say you were raised Jewish. Were you? Jewish family?
No,
you weren't.
Matter of fact, no.
I wasn't sure. I was going to say, because Jews in Arkansas, I'm Jewish, so I'm like, I can't imagine a Jew.
Well, you know, there were probably three when I was there.
Yeah, I bet that's true. So listen to me. So you go off to college, you do your thing. You know, obviously you're going to be go on to great things. You won an Emmy for your coverage of the 1978 Cleveland mayoral race.
That was, you know, quite a story. I mean, in this business, as you know, you were sort of given a front row ticket to the bazaar. And one of my earlier experiences was covering all that was going on in Cleveland when I was in local news. And you might remember Dennis Kucinich was the boy mayor at the time, and he later became a congressman. And he was taking on the economic establishment of the city. And it was just a wild story. And it sort of whetted my appetite for doing the bizarre kind of story, which, of course, brings us to the present. And nothing is more bizarre than the political campaign we're seeing.
What, you think? Unbelievable. We're going to get there in a minute, but I have a couple of more things I want. You wound up at CNN.
Sure.
You were at CNN for, what, 20 years?
21 years, yeah.
That's just extraordinary right then and there. And that's like the beginning of CNN, right?
Right. I wasn't there for the very beginning. By the way, I refer to it as my CNN phase. But I was there from the mid 80s until the mid 20s, whatever you want to call it. That is when we really grew up. As a result, I got to get a front row seat to just about all the great stories of the time.
I think that truly is amazing. When you look at the stories that you covered over the years, that resume of yours, there are very few out there who are still standing, by the way, and you are still standing with that kind.
I mean, again, that is what is so much fun about the business. And as you well know, the business is an awful lot of hard work. It's very, very hard on your families. It's oftentimes very tedious, but it's still, you're getting to play. You're getting to go out there. And when there's a Clarence Thomas hearing, for instance, which is until recently was one of the most bizarre stories I ever covered, I get to cover it. And if you remember, that was just was remarkable.
Ugly.
The hearings for the Supreme Court justice. But, you know, to cover wars and do all that kind of thing, it's like as I said, never growing up.
So that's it. You think you have to have a certain, like, I'm never going to grow up. I'm just going to, I think what it is I think from my own career, you know, we just got guts that nobody else has. I think that's
a
lot of
either
it.
That or
stupidity.
Lack of a brain.
Exactly.
You know?
I know I go back and forth like you do between those two things. You know, why did I say yes to that? Why did I do that? Oh, my God, well, I must be crazy. You left CNN, right?
And then the other thing is, I am very lucky that I have a wonderful, loving family and a very supportive family. So they were willing to put up with all that kind of stuff. And that's, as you well know, the real pressure in this business is that it just really requires an awful lot of personal sacrifice. When news happens, off you go.
Choose between family and news. I bet you for a long time you said news, right?
Well, I didn't have to. I didn't have to.
That's a lucky guy.
But that is what makes me particularly lucky.
So you got a really good wife, huh?
Yeah,
that's nice.
Good wife, good family, very loving family.
That's good to put on the air, right? Every once in a while to talk about that, because I do think it is a family business in a way, because of the sacrifice that the family has to endure while we run around the world being crazy folks. So you left CNN, and I want to talk to you about it in this respect, because I think at the time that you left, that may be the beginning of the end of the news business as we knew it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it was more gradual than that. First of all, I don't want to sound pompous about where the news business is now. There are really so many people in journalism, including television journalism, who I hugely admire. It is a very hard job to do. They are very conscientious about it. We could go forever if I were to name names and all that kind of stuff. At the same time, it became more corporate. And of course, corporate is all about profits, but not only that, but corporate is also about not having the slightest idea what journalism is about. They don't understand the idea that they, being the executives of the corporations, that you're not supposed to follow orders, that kind of thing, if you're a journalist. In other words, they don't have a great affection for us. And I think that after a while, that has contributed to the deterioration of news media in general.
I also think that there's another aspect to that, and it's partly that, for sure. But I also think that a lot of it also has to do with the people that we cover, at least in terms of politics. Their game.
Well,
go ahead. I'll let you go right with it. Go for it.
Well, I mean, what has happened is, and I think this is just an extension of that, the people in politics have become, in recent years, in recent decades, probably starting with Richard Nixon, have come more from advertising, from marketing, and they don't really have much respect for the journalistic process. It's whatever sells. And we saw it with Richard Nixon, and we're seeing it now. And what we're seeing now is a Donald Trump who is basically a performer who's been able to convince the American people, or a substantial number of Americans, that he is the solution to the very real problems that we have in this country.
He's not alone, according to you. You used the P word for the president of the United States. You said he was propagandized.
Well, yeah. I mean, what we have now is a system that is based on propaganda, or whatever word you want to use, marketing, whatever, and very little to do with substance.
That right there, think about that. Think about what you just said. Think about how frightening that is.
I try not to think about what I just said.
Well, think about it, because it's true. It really is true. I mean, you know what? It's like we're in a race to the lowest common denominator, and I said that. What say you?
Well, you know, this is nothing new. I mean, who was it, Newton Minow, who talked about that? The FCC commissioner decades ago, that kind of thing. I'm trying to remember what it is exactly he said, but it was basically that. It's the lowest common denominator. But television news requires on holding people's attention, particularly television, video news, that type of thing. And you don't do it by boring people. Unfortunately, so many of the issues that are vital in this country are boring as all get out. They just are. There's an expression, and I'm sure you've heard it. It's called MIGO, and it means my eyes glaze over. And you can't do a MIGO story. you can't hold people's attention.
Okay, we talked about the suits, and we talked about, you know, the changing nature of the business, and we talked the politicians. But let's talk about journalists themselves. Are they being as well trained today as we were? Are they, you know, are they there? And I, you know, there's a collective, so let's not do that, because there are many, many, many good. I'm sure there are equally as many bad. Is that a problem, though? Is there something going on in your opinion, because you work with young people as much as you work with the old guys, that they aren't quite as savvy or something?
Well, first of all, how do you train for this business? And the answer is you get experience. There is no real training. I mean, I always, and I don't want to be provocative or offend people, I always thought that journalism school, taking journalism as a major, had limitations. The only way that you can really learn how to cover a story is to go out there and cover the story. And there was a time when experience mattered. But what has happened in so many levels of our society for a variety of reasons is people who are doing the hiring are saying, you know what, we don't care about experience. We don't even care if we do that job, good a job, covering the news, as long as our profits are maintained.
Well, isn't that the truth? You know, I was thinking about, I called you the other day about something that I was working on, because I always love your opinions on stuff. And it's interesting to me, because I remember coming up, I had so much regard for my editors and all the people above me. And I'm not so sure that that is true today, that you have the quality of, and I'm talking now, and strength and guidance that we used to have in the old days. Because you couldn't get away with anything in the old days. I think you can now.
Well, I absolutely. And if you're wrong, it's sort of like, I mean, even if you're monumentally wrong, when somebody, for instance, has grossly misreported what the Supreme Court has done, as an example, the horror about it lasts about 30 seconds, and then they say, oh, well, and they expect everybody to forget about it, which, of course, we all do. I mean, as a society, I think that we have the collective memory of a gnat.
That's very true. That's very true. Yeah. But things speed along so fast these days. SWAT, SWAT, next, right? That's how we are.
Right. Well, that's right. And, it's just sort of like the Tofflers. And you remember that they wrote Future Shock.
Right.
And the point that they made in Future Shock was that not that there would be progress. We could handle that. But this acceleration, this constant acceleration of progress. And I think we're seeing that being played out when we look at the Internet and the faster and faster dispensing of information.
And too much information. You've got such a great mind. I know that you read everything that you can possibly read, see everything, just imbibe, right? It's all in there. It's like, there it is. But how much can you take in? And how much do you retain? And how long do you stay on it? Because,
well,
it's always to the next.
You know, there's a lot of information out there, but there's not enough context. So you're barraged with facts, and you're barraged then with people who are perfectly willing, for whatever reason, to misinterpret those facts for their own benefit. And there isn't really a tradition, an individual tradition anymore, of saying, oh, wait a minute, let me step back and apply my values to it and apply some history to it and all that. That is no longer something that people do.
I don't think people read past the headlines myself. And, you know, you got to be a great headline writer today to help get that story going. That's my opinion. Bob, let's get sleazy.
Let's do what?
Let's get sleazy. We've been too serious. let's go into the dirt.
this is so sudden now.
I know, darling. I know.
I've never tried that line, to walk up to somebody in a bar and say, "Hi, let's get sleazy."
Okay, so let me do it correctly. Let's get sleazy. Okay, let's just do it. Let's just go down in the dirt. So let me bring this name up, Clinton.
Which one?
Well, I think sleaze. I go with one. You may go with the other. I'm not sure. But you covered those Clintons since day one, just about. It's really pretty phenomenal. I think there's nobody probably who knows them better than you do, from inside out, outside in. And I think that's fascinating, because I think your perspective on their story probably is a lot different than maybe some others because of, you know, how close you work with them and watch them. I remember you saying to me, you were there when they were like, you know, the first time you ran for governor and blah, 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 blah. So you see whatever happened from a very, as I said, different perspective. But here's what I want to go. It's a reign, as far as I'm concerned. It's like the king and the queen. That's how long they've been in the public arena. And that's how big a role the two of them have. I know that you're not his number one fan or hers. Talk to me a little bit from your perspective on them.
Well, you know, first of all, this is going to sound a little bit sanctimonious, but I'm not either a fan or a non-fan of anybody I cover. I consider them to be sort of objects, you know, and they're human objects, of course. But when I'm working, I'm just
objective,
skeptical,
objective.
But here you have in Bill and Hillary Clinton. In one way, they're very suited. They are brilliant. These are two people who, even though they came from different backgrounds, who are in fact intellectually superior to most of us, certainly to me. Okay, but there is sometimes a feeling that they are so smart that they can't really relate to us little people, us less enlightened people. And along the line, they sort of came up with the idea that if they're confronted with some sort of controversial question, if they're confronted with some sort of resistance, they can dissemble, they can talk their way out of it. Some people would call it an arrogance. Some people would call it hubris. And as a result, when I'm covering them, I have to make sure that I'm parsing every word because I know they are.
Okay. Are they that different than others today?
No. It's a matter of degree. But now you have people who, starting with him and now starting with her, who are saying, believe in me. And my problem is that what I have discovered is that within our political system, it's really tough to believe in anybody anymore. Maybe it's because we're ungovernable. But what I have found is that I can't really trust what they or any of the other politicians are saying.
Well, I guess that's my point. And I'm going to couch it this way. They've been on the scene for so long. They have endured more hits than just about anybody. The fact that they're still standing, the fact that she just got, you know, the nomination, you know, sewn up. That's remarkable considering how many people, how many gazillion dollars, how many ops have gone after them to bring them down and they still survive. Does that not make them properly paranoid?
Well, one could make that argument, but that would also mean, if you accept that as a premise, that they are not fit then to govern. You can't necessarily govern defensively. You at some point have to be forthright with the people who you're dealing with, which is to say the American people, and through the press, that kind of thing. They don't have a high regard for the press, much of it we deserve, but at the same time, we ask questions that they damn well have to answer.
So I keep thinking to myself, and nobody's listening, this is between you and me. I just keep thinking to myself that they're just playing this game out, right? They're doing what they have to do. They're, in a way, she's kept her head very low through this whole thing. She's just starting to surface now. I have an opinion here, and my opinion is that once she gets the official nomination, and if she were to become the queen, if you will, I think we'd see a very different Hillary, and for that matter, Bill. They got nothing to lose.
Well, they are very, very ambitious. I mean, that's quite the understatement. They're ambitious
sure.
enough that they've each run for president and that kind of thing. And they've had some good fortune. They've also had the good fortune of being facing off against an opposition that has been heavy-handed, that has been transparently shameless, that kind of thing, that has made mountains out of molehill when it comes to the scandals that they've had to cover. The Clintons' mistake has been that they've been disingenuous in the way that they've handled all these different controversies. But nevertheless, one could argue that a lot of them were just a tempest in a teapot. Now they're fortunate because the one that she is running against is, in the minds of many people, a maniac.
There's another side to it, which is you could also say, Bob, that we may not like the way that they played it, but they're still standing.
Well, one could make that point. But when one is asked to believe in them, then I think that you have to temper that and say, no, I'm not ready to believe in them in the same way that I'm not ready to believe in anybody. Again, speaking as a reporter and as a journalist, and they are going to have to accept the fact that when there are valid questions to ask, they're going to, in fact, answer them, and they're going to have to answer them forthrightly. And if they don't, if they appear over a long period of time to be parsing their words and sort of noodling around with the truth, that is going to create problems for them.
And I guess my argument to you back is, just to play devil's advocate, that once she gets elected at that point, it may be a very different game because they're done. You know, she may get 8 years, she may get four, but they're done. That's it. Goodbye and good luck. Let me bring up this point. This is amazing to me. It surprises me it hasn't been brought up enough, but the fact of the matter is, if they do get elected, did you hear me? They get...
I heard that, yeah.
You heard that. And then there's another story here that I think that doesn't get enough attention and really should, but I mean, they've just run rings around, what is it, the 22nd Amendment? He's back in office. Don't tell me he's not. He is.
Well, back in office doing what?
Running the country.
Well, except that one could argue, and I'm going to make the argument that that's a little bit sexist, that in fact that she will be perfectly capable of running the country and that he is going to have to understand that he now has a subordinate role.
Well, I said they. I think it was they the first go around, as much as I think it will be they the second go around. She was very active first lady.
Well, she was, and there's no reason to sort of be the devil's advocate to your devil's advocacy. This could get confusing.
Drive everybody crazy, right?
but one could argue that to have a first lady who has actually been there, or first dude, I guess is the expression we've come up with, is not a half bad thing. That this is an advisor who the pillow talk can be really worthwhile.
Assuming they share the same bed. I didn't say that, but I did. But here, the thing is, it's. Right. I'm going to say to you this, though. I wasn't being sexist because it had nothing to do with that. It just had to do with getting back into position. I think she's eminently qualified on her own two legs, two feet and one brain. But I also think that they have always been a team. And I think you would know that better. But I'm sure you saw that even going back to Arkansas, how much she is one half of that team.
Well, and one could argue that that's a pretty good thing.
I do think it is.
In fact, you know, that what she learned, the lesson that she learned when she was the junior member of the team, so to speak, when he was president, and she put together a health care plan, a badly needed health care plan. She made the mistake, because she is kind of secretive in the way that she operates, of going behind closed doors and shutting a lot of people out and not acknowledging the political realities and that kind of thing. And so she failed. Well, the good thing about that is maybe she's learned a few lessons.
You know, she's not a good politician. She really isn't. She's a wonk. She's a brainiac. That's good. That's probably all she picked him, handsome as the day is long. And, you know, incredibly adorable and charming and brilliant to boot. I mean, he really is at all. It's interesting to me when you put it in terms of that may have been part of the problem she's had and why Trump rose, because she was so bad out there and on that trail. And I thought the campaign was really interesting in the way that it took them a while to figure out that they had to start saying publicly, look, she is a lousy politician. She's really not good you know, on the stump, unless she's on a one-on-one with people or in a small venue. The minute they started throwing that, you know, jazzy line out, that was the end of it. People started to forgive her for being really a bloody boar.
Well, she is saddled with a tremendous intellect, and oftentimes that means that you sort of process everything as opposed to just reacting. And I think that a politician has to be able to just react. Now, of course, you have the other extreme, and that would get us to Donald Trump. And I think if we're going to be even-handed about this conversation, we're going to have to talk about him. But he is somebody who is really good at shooting from the hip. Now, Mario Cuomo is the one who said you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. The problem is going to be to try and make sure that we're not so attracted to the poetry that we forget about the prose that follows, and that is how effectively will this person govern? And I think that you said it yourself. Hillary Clinton is, by all accounts, somebody who is at least experienced. Somebody else will have to decide whether she's qualified, but she has the experience in government, and that would probably be something that people need to take note of, but they haven't so far because she's such a lousy campaigner.
You are listening to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. My guest today is Emmy-winning journalist and political commentator Bob Franken. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. Hi, this is Hallie Kasser Jane. Are you enjoying the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKasserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. And we are back on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. Thank you for being here.
Well, I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago, and I think I went through the whole thing about her and about Trump and blah 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 blah. And you know, he's so dynamic. There's no question about that. And at the end, I wrote, be careful.
That would be one word.
Well, yeah. Well, we'll get to the others in a minute or two, but for sure. But the thing about it that you have to say at the end of the day, you know, all that glitters is not gold, because that's the problem there. And, you know, going back to Kennedy, which was when we had somebody, you know, the first telegenic, not that word. Do we even use that word anymore? But the first telegenic man running for president. And ever since, that's been an issue, you know, who looks good on stage, you know, who photographs well, who doesn't sweat under the light of the camera. And in a way, I think this is another referendum on that, because do you go with the one who's, you know, Mr. Glitter and gold and so shiny that you can't take your eyes off of him, but God knows what he says, or you go with her? I think that's what a lot of people need to understand, is where part of what they're going to have to come to terms with in their heads, because needless to say, I, like you, talk politics with people all day long, and it astonishes me some of the reasons that people say that they're voting for whomever it is, that whichever they're voting for. You got
it. Well, you know, it's quite interesting. I mean, John F. Kennedy perhaps was the start of that, where you're voting for the charismatic candidate. But then, if you move ahead a couple of decades, then you had Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was an actor, and he was able to take his aw shucks demeanor and just run his opposition into the ground. Jimmy Carter was probably eminently more qualified. But he was beaten by Ronald Reagan. And then you got to Barack Obama, who basically was able to use his charisma and his storyline to be successful and be two terms. And you had George W. Bush, who in his way was able to take on and beat, in the minds of at least the Republicans, he was able to beat Al Gore, who had long experience and all that kind of thing. In each case, the personality seemed to, and dare I say the word, trump the qualifications. And now we get to the point of Donald Trump, who not only shoots from the hip, but he shoots people from the hip. And you know, makes one insane comment after another, and one hateful comment after another, and is taking advantage, first of all, in his showmanship ability, and taking advantage of the fact that people are just mad as hell and aren't going to take it anymore. And he is taking a page out of those demagogues who have in the past preyed on people's anger and their resultant bigotry and all that kind of thing. And he's built a successful operation.
So tell us what you really think, my friend.
What's that?
I said, so tell us what you really think, my friend.
Well, no, actually, that is the milder version.
No, it's perfectly fine with me. So let's talk beauty pageants, Mr., because that's him. I mean, you know what he reminds me of? You know, in that horrible moment in a beauty pageant these days when they're trying to say, you know, show that their pageant people have this wonderful intellect along with all, you know, big breasts and whatever. They ask them those questions at the end, you know, and they get a minute to answer them. Every comment at it, and they always bungle it, and it's always terrible. And
right.
It's always, and that's Trump. I mean, it's Trump. It's like one beauty pageant answer after the next. It's insane.
Well, yeah. And you know, he's been likened many times to Howard Beale,
Network,
the crazy anchorman in the movie Network. And he is tapped in to that kind of anger. And by the way, the anger is justified. I mean, we are being totally taken by a rigged system that favors the wealthy, who, in fact, pass laws or see to it that laws are passed that protect their wealth to the detriment of everybody else. And Donald Trump has tapped into that anger.
Oh, I'm not going to argue with you on that. I think that's absolutely the truth. I think the thing with Donald Trump is he's got a message. He's got an important message. There is no doubt about that. Whether he
What do you think the message is?
Well, what am I on? what are you?
No, I'm turning the tables on you.
Yeah, I could tell that you're turning the tables on me. I actually think that, you know, what he's saying is on a lot of levels, hey, the system is rigged and I'm going to fix it for you. I'm going to pay attention to you. You're hurting. I hear you. Let's fix it. He has no fix because he doesn't understand the reasons the system is screwed up the way that it is. My point that I was going to make was he's got a message. He's just the wrong messenger. And
well,
I think
he is.
Right.
He is, and he's also somebody who, at the very least, is amoral. Whatever it takes to get his followers riled up, he is willing to say. If in fact he wants to scapegoat the Muslims, let's do it. If he wants to scapegoat the Mexicans, let's do it. If he wants to scapegoat women, let's do it. He's almost like a nightclub act.
He is a nightclub act. I will tell you, in the beginning, he almost had me. I'll admit that on air. I mean, I was absolutely stunned because I thought that a lot of what he was saying or does say. Now, I'm from New York or New Jersey originally, but New York. I grew up with the Donald Trumps of the world. I understand that whole thinking of these guys, and particularly he's like a throwback, by the way, to like the generation before him, which is kind of amusing. Nobody brings that up, but it's true. You know, that tough kind of, you know, macho kind of, you know, rat pat kind of guy. That's who he is, you know, like a little tinge of mafia in him. It's a lot of bluster, too.
You talk about mafia, and quite frankly, there have been some indications that there's more than just a little bit in him, in his various business dealings and all that kind of thing. But he has been able to develop a persona that is really anti-political at a time when anti-political, everybody's anti-political.
And I think that's true, you know, and that line, you know, about being politically incorrect, I do think that is a very relevant topic of conversation for a lot of people, you know, in this nation right now who feel like they got screwed because, you know, everybody's trying to be so politically correct and not really say what the heck is going on. I think those things all play into it. I almost bought it. I didn't buy it, of course. I got out of it. But he suffers from foot and mouth disease. There's no question about that. And the GOP wants to rein him in. He is just like a wild horse. You can't pull the rein in on him. So what happens? Is he going to implode? I mean, how in the world does he keep going day after day after day, Bob, he puts his foot in that proverbial
mouth.
Well,
beyond putting his foot in his mouth, he basically makes a mockery of the Constitution. I mean,
the most
recent one is that he has decreed that the Washington Post will not be able to cover him. Why? Because he didn't like the stories in the Washington Post. You know, forgive my English, but too damn bad. That's the way it's supposed to work.
You know, narcissism can go so far as to be a mental disorder. What is he going to do? He's held a lot of other papers. He's shut them down. So eventually, who's going to cover him?
Well, in his ideal world, the ones who will cover him are the ones who do the glowing stories about him. I mean, I think that he has decided that he can run roughshod over the press and other institutions, that he can run roughshod over the need to be measured in his comments and all that kind of stuff. One of the reasons he can is because we're in the mess that we're in, and we are in a mess in the United States right now. Again, I get back to who I blame, and that is the very wealthy who have managed to, in my mind, take money from the middle class. It's sort of I call it is hood robin. Donald Trump has been able to tap into that anger. But what he has done is that he has scapegoated. And I think that that is incredibly dangerous. I mean, need I tell you about the last person who did that?
Well, I think that that is true. But I want to turn the tables on you. So what do you see as the important message?
What do I see as the important message right now?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we are going to have to revisit the idea of privilege for the wealthy. I think that we're going to have to go back to being a country that was envisioned as an egalitarian country where, in fact, people shared the wealth. And what has happened is, over a period of time, a few people have managed to amass most of the wealth. For instance, they talk about how the economy has recovered. No, it hasn't.
Of course not.
What has happened is that the rich, the few rich, have managed to, in fact, get back to where they were, and in fact, more. But most of the people out there, in fact, have been in a downward spiral economically for at least a couple of decades. So this did not start recently. Certainly, many people think that it started with the Reagan years when President Reagan broke the unions, for instance, and in the minds of many, obliterated the middle class. Be that as it may, you've had a system that has, in fact, been rigged, and both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders speak of it that way. By the way, they are able to paint the Clintons now as part of the problem, that being part of the establishment. So you have a Donald Trump who comes along, who's able to tap into that anger, and people say, I don't care whether what he's saying is crazy. At least he's against the people who I hate.
But more like that man that you were talking about, Hitler. It's a very ugly message. There's no question about that. And then we can't talk about him and not talk about the Republican Party, which is just what in the world? What in the world? How do they tolerate this? How do they play this? You know, and Bob, they go after Clinton and say she's, you know, amoral or immoral or she's this, that, and the other thing. What the hell are each one of those people who endorses this and allows this to go on? By the way, I was happy to hear today that South Dakota, a Republican, said, I'm voting for Hillary. I mean, the ceiling is starting to find its cracks on that thing. What's your thought?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of people, certainly among the liberals, who have no sympathy for the Republican Party at all. Certainly in the last presidency, that is to say the Barack Obama presidency, they have at least passive-aggressively been racist. They have been the people who have just blocked every initiative that would benefit more people than just their wealthy patrons, that kind of thing. And so they really created a climate, at least in the minds of many, that was fertile ground. I'm mixing my metaphors here. But they created a climate where a Donald Trump could thrive. And so he comes along, and all of a sudden he's saying the obvious extension of what they've been hinting at over the last several years, and now they're embarrassed to be confronted by that. And so now they have this question. Are they going to be quislings and go along with him and hope that he somehow doesn't succeed, or are they going to stand up to him? And for the most part, the they are opting to just keep their heads low.
It's disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting.
Well, it is disgusting, and I think it shows the limitation of the people who are, in fact, in the political realm right now. Most of them are not what I would call nice people.
No, they're not. And I always say this, though, when I hear that line, and I say, well, they didn't get there on their own. We elected them. And that, I think, has got to do with something about how people today are engaged in politics and those sound bites that, and headline reading that I was talking about earlier and you were talking about. The electorate has got some issues that need to be addressed as well. Now, I don't want to go too much into that. I want to go back in one sense to Mr. Trump on this. You know, once he got himself elected, he could have rose to the occasion. He could have.
You're talking about, you mean when he became the presumptive nominee?
Exactly. I'm sorry. Let's be specific. But he could have. He had that option. He could have gone in and started to read and learn and understand policy and he did none of that. That's part of it that I don't quite get. Surely, we don't know how smart he is, but we know how clever he is. He can't be that dumb that he doesn't see that what people are clamoring from him now is a little bit more substance.
Well, except for the fact that, number one, I don't think he's emotionally equipped to do that.
You're cruel.
And besides which, he's from New York. And no New Yorker is emotionally equipped to do that.
Oh, now you stop that right now.
I mean, there's a joke that I can't tell
on the air
about New Yorkers and the tourists asking where the Empire State Building is. I'll try and clean it up. Excuse me, sir, can you tell me where the Empire State Building is, or should I just harm myself? And believe me, that's the cleaned up version. But the point is that this is a guy, and you said it earlier, who is New York as they come. And so that's number one. Number two, the man is a narcissist. And before I start sounding harsh about it, just about anybody who would run for the presidency is a narcissist. Okay.
Well, for sure.
And the other thing is, I'm sure he feels that, hey, this is what got me to this point, so I'm not all of a sudden going to wimp out.
Look, stop picking on New Yorkers right now, because, there's some good to most of us.
Oh, did I say something wrong?
No, but I have a big
New York. Let me just make sure that we understand. And New Yorkers, at least, are very, very upfront. They stab you in the front. I came from a part of the country,
right,
the South, where, the opposite is true. So.
Well, I can relate to that because I grew up in New York and then moved to the South, and it's been a huge lesson in learning about protecting one's back.
Talk about culture shock.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's crazy, right? It's just absolutely crazy. It's just style. That's all that it is. It's style. But back to to Mr. Trump and all of this, and I want to bring up what happened the other day in Orlando, just up the road from me. The kid was just down the road from me. This is such a horror to me. Absolutely beyond. And I'm sure it is to you and to anybody who's listening to the show.
Sure.
But here's the deal. He played with that. And that to me was unconscionable. And at that point, when he's saying that Mr. Obama, is a Muslim, the guy's a conspiracy theory, anything that he can figure out that he's going to call Obama, he's going to call him or anybody else for that matter. I want to talk about that because I think it disqualified him when he suggested that the president should resign. Now, you wrote about that. Talk to me.
Well, I guess my question would be, if that disqualifies him, what about his views on blocking all Muslims from coming to the country or, in effect, spying on them? What about his views about deporting 11 million illegal immigrants?
Well, that's
what about
just stupid.
His views on womanhood? What about his various views on race, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? The thing about it is that there are any number of reasons why he should have been disqualified, but he is still able to, in the words of his supporters, speak his mind. Doesn't matter that what he is speaking is just toxic as all get out. He is nevertheless tapping into the anger, I can't say this enough, of people who are basically saying, I don't care if it's civilized or not. I just want change.
Well, I hear that argument. I think there is a slight difference in all of those A, B, C, D, E, F, G that you listed, you know, ridiculous things that he said, which could be interpreted multi ways, to what he said about the president and, you know, he should resign. I think that went over the line, personally. I can understand some of the other stuff that he says. I can hear what the people hear, which is when he says that all Muslims should be, you know, banned temporarily from entering the United States. That I can understand why people would glean onto that. I can understand the fear. I talk to people around here. Oh, I live in Trump country, by the way, and I'm not. Obviously, it's bizarre. But I understand that fear that those people are expressing and why they you know, hear it the way they want to hear it from him. But I think he did something really wrong with this comment about the president and how he's handling all of this. I just do. Personally, that's how I feel. And he didn't get enough. He didn't take it on the chin to the degree that he should have by a lot of different people and a lot of different, you know, places, the media, you know, politicians, what have you on that. At some point, he's got to get his head, you know, chopped off so that he understands there really is something to people saying you've gone too far.
And yet, to the people who are in his base, the millions of people, by the way, anytime he says anything about Barack Obama, no matter how nasty, no matter how inappropriate, they cheer. Why do they cheer? Well, first of all, Barack Obama is black, and we can't tiptoe around that. We have to, in fact, acknowledge the fact that a lot of this is racism, as is, for instance, the Donald Trump history of questioning where Barack Obama was born, that kind of thing. In addition to which, you have a Republican Party that has politely said the same kind of thing for a long time. So Donald Trump says, I think he should step down because he implies that he's, you know, sympathetic to the Muslim extremists and all that kind of thing. It's just the people out there who support him, the millions of people out there who support him, are saying, yeah, way to go, Donald. I've been thinking the same thing.
It defies.
Well, it really makes you wonder about the state of this country. I just wrote a column about, I was watching the Tony Awards the other night, and of course it was the same Sunday that Orlando had happened and all of that. And of course Hamilton won all the awards. And I was wondering, thinking to myself, you know, the founding fathers with this vision they had of this egalitarian society and all of that, if they were alive today, would be so disappointed in what has happened to their grand dream.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Absolutely agree with you. The thing also, the one other thing about Trump that I think is kind of interesting in all of this is how much he really believes what he says, or this is just he knows it's the winning hand, and will we ever really know? I'm not so quick to jump on the bandwagon and say the guy is a racist or the guy is a, you know, hates women or whatever the hell. So much as I just think he gets how the American people are today and he plays into it.
The question I have is whether he even takes time to figure out what he does believe or whether he just lives in the moment.
You say he's shooting from the hip.
And I'm inclined to think that that may be the case. You know, you're mad at Muslims? Well, then make some grandiose, inappropriate statement about what you would do about the problem. If he wants to make a joke about women, yeah, let's do. People are going to get that. You know, all this kind of thing.
The man is running for the presidency of the United States, and he believes that the president of the United States was not born in the United States.
Well, but you know, the Republican Party has treated Barack Obama as if he is not really validly the president of the United States.
Well, yeah, but we'll never know whether that was race-based or whether that was just, we can't believe we lost again. We're not going to give this guy an
or
edge.
Or a combination thereof.
Or a combination thereof. I mean, on that level, you can understand it. But this guy saying, this conspiracy thing goes back before... I mean, maybe he knew he was going to run, and he's been running this game, you know, for the last 5 years, and we didn't even realize that he was ginning up towards it. It just, to me, is just something that's unbelievable, unbelievable, and unbelievable he's gotten as far as he goes. So let's do this, though, as we get ready to close. A couple of weeks ago, you and I had talked, actually, and we were like, took the temperature, it's Trump's. I'm not so sure I think that's true right now. I think Hillary's been very effective in bringing him down a little bit. What do you think?
Well, I think that Hillary has cleaned up her act a little bit, for sure. I think most of the blame, though, for Trump's being taken down is because of Trump. I mean, he has, in fact, gone beyond crazy, so to speak. Again, his reaction to the negative coverage you get, by God, forget the First Amendment. I'm not going to allow them to cover me. That is just an absurdity. And when it's piled upon the absurdity of a couple days ago and the absurdity of a couple days before that, on and on ad nauseum, at some point it's going to work like erosion and maybe wear them down a little bit.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
Well, the thing about it is though, that in any case, I don't like what his success says about the United States of America. One could worry, and I am, and in the column that I wrote, I talked about the founding fathers, worrying that maybe the country is starting to become disunited, that it's really starting to sort of fall apart.
I think that the tsetse fly has bitten a lot of America, and I think that some people react to the bite differently than others, but I still think that we have a chance to write this and find a solution, if you will, stay with it, you know, for the virus. That's what I think. I don't think we're so far gone. But I do think that if he were to win this election, we are in deep, deep gaga. That's what I think.
Well, yeah, here's what's interesting. If he wins the election and people just really can't stand the cold in Canada, he is going to keep his promise. Mexico, in fact, will build the wall. And the reason that Mexico will build the wall is to keep out all the people from the United States who are trying to flee to Mexico.
Yeah, hasta la vista, baby. I'm going south. I'm out of here. But okay, so if you put that, bring this all back into perspective, you know, this is a very interesting conversation. God knows you're a delight. Here's what's fascinating.
Go ahead.
We can talk and talk and talk. You have to admit, it's a lot more fun to talk about him than Hillary.
Well, it's perverse fun. And forget about Hillary. I mean, she, let's face it, she is also quite the story for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is she's a historic figure. Could potentially be the first woman president, which is no small story. But, there's sort of a perverse fun in watching Don Rickles run for president.
Don Rickles. Yeah, you know, I was thinking the other day, you know, we had a black president, we had a Catholic president, we may have a woman president. Those Jews who supposedly run the country, all those people who are backing Mr. Trump, who hate my tribe, we don't seem to be able to get there. Not sure I understand it. We almost had Bernie, if you want to call him a Jew, and I don't. And maybe before we close, we should say a word or two about Bernie now that I mentioned him. You got anything to say about Bernie? Like, go gently into the good night and get the hell out of Dodge already? You're boring me.
Well, you know, he identified the enemy, so to speak. That is to say, a society that is, in fact, rigged in favor of the wealthy. It's just that what he was proposing were simplistic solutions that had no chance whatsoever of taking effect because the the rich and wealthy control the government right now, and they control the propaganda apparatus, which is to say television and the media and all that kind of stuff, in that they're able to afford whatever amount of commercials that is needed to, in fact, sway people's minds and get them to vote against their interests. So Bernie Sanders perhaps did a service in that he was able to amplify some of the concerns that people have. But in fact, he really didn't offer solutions that were workable.
Of course he did not. And but, you know, it's interesting also with him. I think this is so true, though. The guy fascinates me on a lot of levels. One is, I hope when he has time to comb his hair when he, you know, retires, because what a wreck. But the other part of him that I find interesting is the fact that he did not say, by the way, and I thought he was very clever, that he would support Hillary. He said he would make sure that Donald Trump doesn't win. There's very much a difference in those two statements.
Yeah.
He's the last angry man.
Yeah, but there is. But at some point, that means telling people you can't stay home. You've got to go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. Yes, we're angry at her, but she is the choice between that and chaos for the country.
So true, so true. It's been a pleasure talking with you, sir. You'll come back again.
What a pleasure this has been.
And we'll do it again sometime, I hope.
I hope so.
I've been speaking with Emmy Award-winning journalist Bob Franken. You can read his columns in newspapers across the country or on the internet at bobfranken.tv. Follow Bob on Facebook and Twitter at FrankenB. Thanks so much for tuning in to the LA Cancer Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit LAcancerJane.com.